Watch It Burn is a proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. Go to newmediarevolution.org to listen to the others. I have to say, they're pretty cool. I mean, hell, they invited me to be a part of it, right? I mean, they're good people. They don't kick puppies or take bribes or steal their employees' pensions. That's got to count for something, right? On the Progressive Podcast Network at newmediarevolution.org, we don't kill civilians. We only kill lies. Godless Kids are here, podcasting to you from LSA Anaconda near beautiful sunny Balad, Iraq. It's been another week, and you know what that means. It's time once again to hunker in the bunker for another episode of Watch It Burn. Watch It Burn is dedicated to the memory of Sergeant Brian Brewster and all of our comrades who have fallen, from the militia of Captain John Parker to the soldiers of today. Welcome back, everybody. Imagine my surprise, my pleasant surprise, when I came to work this evening. And as I came walking up to the platoon office, there's a little breezeway between there and a little outbuilding that's attached to it by a deck that we use as a recreation room. We get a TV in there with the AFN set up to the antenna, and they have a PlayStation 2, I think it is, in there, and some games and movies and whatnot. People go in there and relax in the air conditioning when they don't have any work to do. Myself, I have my shop. It's air conditioned, so I can just kick back in here. This little squeaking noise you're hearing is actually me relaxing and leaning back in the really comfy chair here on my dinner break right now. But as I came up, there was a large group of guys sitting there in the breezeway, and man, I really digressed on that one, didn't I? I tend to do that, and actually I'm doing so again, so I better stop. Anyway, this group of guys is sitting in the breezeway, about a half dozen of them. I think it was either five or six. And as I walk up, one of them says, "Hey man, it's Sunday." And I didn't get what he was saying, or what he meant by that, so it's not really much different from any other day. I mean, he says, "Are you going to record anything tonight?" And I didn't even know he was aware of my podcast, and I still didn't put two and two together when I heard that they had an iPod hooked up to some little speakers there, and, excuse me, they were listening to some Beastie Boys, I thought. And I heard it, and I was like, "Hey, that's In a World Gone Mad. I don't know if you guys would know that one." I said, "Hey, dumbass, this is your podcast." And so there were six guys from the company, a couple from my platoon and a couple from other platoons, were just sitting there jaw-jacking between tasks and listening to my podcast. So pretty stoked about that. This is probably going to be going up a lot quicker than the usual interval between shows, even though the last one went up, on Saturday or Friday or Saturday, either the 26th or the 27th, I can't recall which, by y'all's time, back in the world. But I'm going to put this one up pretty quickly because I just want to try to get back on the regular schedule, and I was just stoked to hear them doing that. Now that I'm over my head cold for the most part, you'll hear me sniffling a little bit here and there and clearing my throat like that now and then because I still have a little bit of crud in me. But I also wanted to immediately get back on here because something I had mentioned on previous podcast has been picked up by a few other people that are members of the Progressive Podcast Network with me. Oh, damn neighbors, freaking loud as hell again. Let's just wait for this one to take off. And it's cool, while we're waiting for them, I can go ahead and get this article ready. Okay, they've dropped down their noise making there. But I had talked about that massacre in Haditha by a group of Marines. And so I came into work today, and somebody had a copy of today's Stars and Stripes, Sunday, May 28th. And the headline right above the fold is, "Officials, Marines shot Iraqi civilians, quote, execution style. Intelligence photos, witnesses, details..." Come on. Okay. Officials, Marines shot Iraqi civilians, quote, execution style. Intelligence photos, witnesses detail slayings of 24 in Haditha. And we go inside to page 5, and it's a full page of just that story. Well, two stories about the incident. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, so I'm seeing it for the first time here with you guys. Apparently it was about a dozen guys from 3rd Bat, 1st Marine Regiment, 1st MARDIV. They were on their third deployment to Iraq when it occurred. And so most of the fatal shots appear to have been fired only by a few of the Marines, possibly a 4-man fire team led by a sergeant. So, if that's the case, I'm pleased that at least there's the silver lining that there was not a huge number of guys who have lost their minds like this. It's as disgusting as it is. I'm glad it's not a larger. It wasn't a larger element doing this. But according to, they have a graphic here from a Washington Post where eyewitness report, an eyewitness account, says that 7:15 a.m. an IED explosion blows up a Humvee, kills one Marine, wounds two others. And shortly after the attack, the Marines apparently went down a dirt lane from the IED site and entered the Hassan family home, shot to death 7 in the extended family, including one child. From there, they went next door, heading back toward the IED site, just into the very next building, shot to death a husband, wife, and 6 children in the Yunis family, their home. And they went next door again, just the very next house, on the way back to the IED site, and entered the Ahmed family home, killed 4 brothers who shared the house. They returned to near the IED site and opened fire on a taxi, killing 4 college students and the driver. Now, I'm kind of skimming through the article as I go here, so if it ends up kind of disjointed or whatever, please bear with me. First count of the killings in Haditha was a false or erroneous statement issued the next day, November 20th, by a U.S. Marine spokesman from a Marine base in Ramadi, quote, a U.S. Marine and 15 civilians were killed yesterday from the blast of a roadside bomb in Haditha. Immediately following the bombing, gunmen attacked the convoy with a small arms fire. Iraqi Army soldiers and Marines returned fire, killing 8 insurgents and wounding another, end quote. Apparently the incident was touched off when an IED hit a supply convoy of a Gilo Company, 3rd of the 1st Marine Regiment, 1 MARDIV. Killed a 20-year-old Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas from El Paso on his second tour in Iraq. The bomb was off of one of Haditha's main streets, apparently on a side road between 2 vacant lots, which it was in that, apparently, what locals say, the it had been pretty specifically placed in a spot that would not have hit civilian residents. That's according to the local residents. They say that the insurgents have been placing the explosives in locations that are farther from civilian areas. Apparently, 2 other Marines. Terrazas was driving the Humvee and died instantly, and 2 other Marines in the convoy were wounded. And the descriptions of the events provided by witnesses in Haditha could not be independently verified. Other accounts of the number of casualties and identities were corroborated by death certificates. And apparently in the first minutes after the blast, residents say silence reigned on the street of walled courtyards, brick homes, and tiny palm groves. Apparently they said the Marines appeared stunned or purposeful as they moved around the burning Humvee. Then one of the Marines took charge, shouting, said Fahmy, who was watching from his roof. Fahmy said he saw the shouting Marine direct other Marines into the house closest to the blast, about 50 yards away. It was the house of Abdul Hamid Hassan Ali, 76. In the house with Ali and his 66-year-old wife, Kamisa Tuma Ali, were 3 of the middle-aged men of their family, at least 1 daughter-in-law and 4 children, 4-year-old Abdullah, 8-year-old Iman, 5-year-old Abdul Rahman, and 2-month-old Asia. Marines entered shooting, witnesses recalled. Most of the shots in Ali's house and 2 others were fired at such close range they went through the bodies of family members and plowed into walls or the floor, doctors at Haditha's hospital said. A daughter-in-law identified as Hiba escaped with Asia. Survivors and neighbors said Iman and Abdul Rahman were shot but survived. 4-year-old Abdullah, Ali, and the rest died.
Marines moved to the house next door. Inside were 43-year-old Kafif, 41-year-old Aida Yasin Ahmed, and 8-year-old son, 5 young daughters, and a 1-year-old girl staying in the family, according to death certificates and neighbors. The Marines shot them at close range and hurled grenades into the kitchen and bathroom, survivors and neighbors said later. Kafif's pleas could be heard across the neighborhood. 4 of the girls died screaming. Only 13-year-old Safa Yunis lived, saved, she said, by her mother's blood spilling onto her, making her look dead when she fell limp in a faint. Townspeople led a Washington Post reporter last week to the girl they identified as Safa. The girl burst into tears after a few words. The older couple caring for her apologized and asked the reporter to leave. Moving to the third house in the row, Marines burst in on 4 brothers, Marwan, Khatan, Shasib, and Jamal Ahmed. Never said the Marines killed the 4 brothers together. Marine officials said later that one of the brothers had the only gun found among the 3 families, although there have been no known allegation that the weapon was fired. Meanwhile, a separate group of Marines found at least one other house full of young men. Marines led the men in that house outside, some still in their underwear, and away to detention. Final victims of the day happened upon the scene inadvertently, witnesses said. 4 male university students, Khalid Ayad Al-Zawi, Wajdi Ayad Al-Zawi, Mohammed Batal Mahmoud, and Akram Mahamid Flayeh, I hope that's pronounced properly, had left the Technical Institute in Sakhlawiya for the weekend to stay with one of their families in the, on the street, said Fahmi, a friend of the young men. A Haditha taxi driver, Ahmed Hidar, was bringing them home, Fahmi said. According to Fahmi, the young men and their driver turned into the street and saw the wrecked Humvee and the Marines. Kidher threw the car into reverse, trying to back away at full speed, Fahmi said, and the Marines opened fire from about 30 yards away, killing all the men inside. That's pretty much just the direct account of 24 Iraqi civilians shot and killed at close range by a fire team of Marines. One of the neighbors recalled hearing Yunis Salim Khafif plead with, in English for the lives of himself and his family. Fahmi, the primary witness, Awas Fahmi, a Haditha resident, said he watched and listened from his home. I said, I heard Yunis speaking to the Americans saying, I am a friend, I am good, Fahmi said. They killed him and his wife and daughters. Then there's the official, what the investigators are saying happened. So you don't think it's just, you know, that's just what the witness, the main story, that about two-thirds of the page here, 4 columns, is all just, you know, one witness's, a local resident's witness account. But here's the rest of it, what the officials say, is that photographs taken by a Marine intelligence team have convinced investigators that a Marine unit killed up to 24 unarmed Iraqis, some of them, quote, execution style, end quote, in the insurgent stronghold of Haditha after a roadside bomb killed one American last November, officials close to the investigation said Friday. The pictures are said to show wounds to the upper bodies of the victims, who included several women and 6 children. Some were shot in the head and some in the back, according to congressional and defense officials. One government official said the pictures showed that infantry Marines from Camp Pendleton, quote, suffered a total breakdown in morality and leadership with tragic results, end quote. The case may be the most serious incident of alleged war crimes in Iraq by U.S. troops. Now, technically, our invasion and occupation is a war crime, but that's another matter entirely. So, by the fact that it was a unprovoked invasion, it's a violation of a number of treaties, including the UN. I think it's the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, and I believe even the Nuremberg agreements that came out of the Nuremberg trials. The after that, I don't know if it's Nuremberg Protocols, Nuremberg Accords, something like that. But that's a violation of U.S. law then, because as those are treaties, Article 6 of the Constitution states that any treaty entered into by the United States, by the government of the United States of America, is considered the supreme law of the land. So by waging an unprovoked war, we have violated U.S. law, and therefore we're all war criminals. Just like Saddam and Pol Pot and the Soviets and the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese and, oh, who else? Rebel Sadras and any number of others. But anyway, back to the story. The case may be the most serious incident of alleged war crimes in Iraq by U.S. troops. Marine officers have long been worried about Iraq's bloody insurgency could prompt such an overzealous reaction by combat teams. And it, yeah, you think about it, it was pretty much just a matter of time. And unfortunately, we may never know if there was a Hugh Thompson of this incident. If they stopped because somebody got in the way, one of our own said, "This is wrong. This is wrong. You're not going to do this." Like it's a lie when Hugh Thompson landed his helicopter between the troops and the children, and told his and ordered his gunners to train their weapons on the U.S. troops to protect the children. I'm just hoping that it comes out that there was someone with some integrity in that group that realized right from wrong. An investigation by an Army general into the November 19th incident is to be delivered soon to the top operational commander in Iraq. A separate criminal investigation is also underway and could lead to charges ranging from murder to dereliction of duty. Both investigations are centered on a dozen Marines from the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division. The battalion's on its third deployment to Iraq when the killings occurred. Most of the fatal shots appear to have been fired by only a few of the Marines. As I mentioned earlier, the same sergeant is suspected of filing a false report downplaying the number of Iraqis killed, saying they were killed by an insurgent bomb and the Marines entered the Iraqis' homes in search of gunmen firing at them. All aspects of this story are contradicted by pictures, statements by Marines to investigators, and an inspection of the houses involved, officials said. Other Marines may face criminal charges for failing to stop the carnage or for failing to make accurate reports. Of the dead Iraqis, 19 were in 3 to 4 houses the Marines stormed. 5 others were killed near a vehicle. The intelligence team took the pictures shortly after the shooting stopped. Such teams are typically assigned to collect information on insurgents after firefights or other military engagements. Investigators and top officers of the Camp Pendleton-based 1st Mardia, or 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, sorry, habit, say Mardia from when I was in Hawaii, which oversees Marine infantry, aviation, and support units in Iraq, have viewed the pictures. The November 19th incident began when a roadside bomb attached to a large propane canister exploded as Marines passed through the town on the Euphrates River. Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas, who was driving a Humvee, was killed instantly and 2 other Marines were wounded. Marines quickly determined that the bomb was a, quote, line of sight, end quote, explosive that would have required someone to detonate it. The Marines involved in the shooting initially reported they had become embroiled in a firefight with insurgents after the explosion. However, evidence that emerged later contradicted that version. Quote, there wasn't a gunfight, there were no pockmarked walls, said a congressional aide. Quote, the wounds indicated execution-style shootings, end quote, said a Defense Department official who had been briefed on the contents of the photos. Now I'm wondering who's going to be the Colin Powell of this incident. Who's going to be the officer assigned to minimize, downplay, and begin the removal of this from the public consciousness? Who is going to be the Colin Powell, the officer they assigned to put this down the memory hole? Oh, man, I tell you. I had started off in such a great mood. I had started off in such a great mood from hearing the guys here were listening to my podcast. So, well, I need to get back to work. My dinner break is done, and I have to replace a threaded panel fastener insert on a flight control pallet from a CH-47. It's riveting stuff. Well, there's no riveting involved in this one, actually. My usual repairs do. This one is just a pain in the ass. I drill out the part, which is a pain in the ass, and then I have to fill the hole with adhesive and put a new fastener in there, or a new insert in there. And then it's anywhere from 12 to 24 hours waiting time for it to set for them to be able to use it again. So, anyway, I've got the fastener out of it, out of the pallet. Now it's time to grind it out enough to make the new one sit in there right, and I'll put the adhesive in. Anyway, so that's going to be that segment, and I will put more in here probably shortly.
Train your weapons on the GI, and his copter crews obeyed, and stood among the children, tattered and afraid. The whole town had been murdered, but for some kids and widowed wives, and Hugh Thompson made sure that those remaining would survive.
activist?
No, I wouldn't say that.
If mass media exists to invest our lives with artificial notions and arbitrary values, let us take that media back.
How do you possibly think you can make a difference?
We need to talk more, we need to listen, we need to ask more questions.
These are the puppets of the government.
Do not worry for your own safety.
You know, even if they came to bump me off, it would be a hollow victory for them because it would not stop the word spreading. They're too late.
The power of the documentary, the drama of truth, alters our understanding and perceptions of the world around us. You choose mass media or real media for the masses. Audio activism? Sounds good to me. Documentary.com. Documenting the mind.
That was a promo for Documentally.com, of course, as you heard on there, so I'm being redundant, but it's produced by a guy by the name of Christian, a British journalist, photojournalist, who was just recently here in the northern part of Iraq in Kurdistan, and he has contacted me, and I would really... really strongly urge you all to go to his site, christian.com, and check out his photo portfolio. Just some amazing work, really is. And give his podcast a listen. It's pretty good, too. A lot of what he said, he said there on the promo, it's very fitting in line with something that I had been... I'm going to continue working on this thing while I talk to you guys. I can do two things at once a lot of times. But what Jella Biafra from the Dead Kennedys had said is basically that once we realize that the corporate media is lying to us, either directly or lying through omission, it's up to us to become the media. And I think that's one of the big points, the main point of blogs and podcasts and other alternative media such as what we do here and what others are doing on the Progressive Podcast Network at newmediarevolution.org. But if you see something that has happened, you witness some events in your community, and you find that it's something significant, but the corporate media is not covering it in any kind of detail, or they're just putting out bad information on it, or something like that, then, hey, by all means, your best bet to get the word out is to do it yourself. We can't trust them to inform us anymore. Oh man, this feels like my head cold's coming back a little bit. We can't trust them at all, you know, to keep us informed, not with them dominated by big money and political, well, what's the word I'm looking for? Self-pimping. To political interests, and we gotta do it ourselves, and so that's part of what I'm doing here. I figured eventually, you know, being over here, I'd probably see something or be involved in something that was a fairly significant event that was underreported or improperly reported by the mainstream media, and that I would have to set the record straight. And that was one of the reasons why I started my blog to begin with last time I was here. It's partly because of something I had seen on Fox News. Excuse me, Fox News. I always have trouble whenever I try to say those words. Something just wants to kind of force its way out of my guts. And saw something on the news there. They were reporting an incident that had occurred near where I was at. And though I was not involved in the incident itself, I knew people who were. And I remembered that their account of the events differed significantly with the account that Fox News was reporting. And that's when I started fact-checking them, because we did have internet access there at the time. And so I started, you know, fact-checking whenever I would see something on the news, not just Fox News, but just them and CNN, were the only news items that we were really getting at the time through Armed Forces Network. But I would fact check whatever news I saw on television, and I found that a huge percentage of it that I had any kind of direct bearing or direct knowledge of or access to sources myself was just wildly at variance with what had really been going on the ground. And that led me back to the media criticism that I had kind of dabbled in when the wife and I, along with some friends, were putting together a weekly independent magazine back home in Eugene, Oregon, called Sub Rosa, back in 96? Yeah, 96, it was just before my oldest boy was born. But, and I started thinking about how far gone our modern media climate is and how hard it's going to be to take it back, because you're basically talking about big vested money interests. People are making a profit off of news, and news is not supposed to be something you make a profit off of. It's not supposed to be infotainment. It's supposed to be information. And as I think I mentioned, I think I've mentioned it before on the podcast, I find the press to be, in my opinion, just because of, you know, reading little things like the Constitution and the writings of the founders when they were sending letters to correspondents back and forth to each other on their actual intent behind various parts of the Constitution. And as I mentioned before in the earlier podcast, the media is the only industry that is specifically protected in the Bill of Rights. And independent media, being vital and absolutely necessary to the survival of a healthy democracy, the founders made sure to protect that. Because, as I've said before, if you're not fully informed of the issues and platforms, you can't make an informed decision at the ballot box. That's why it is vitally important that we, the people, take back the media. And if necessary, that may mean becoming the media ourselves. And I see that's happening a lot. And it's a nice thing. I like it. Sure, you know, there can be some confusion when there's a multiplicity of voices. But at least you know that if you're hearing a lot of different people saying a lot of different things about the same issue or the same events or the same persons, you can guarantee that somewhere among those 15 or 20 voices you're hearing, one of them's telling you the truth. That makes it a lot easier. If you're hearing 8 different voices at the major news media, the corporate media, if you hear it on ABC and NBCBS, then, and it's all of them are saying the same thing, there's no way of knowing if it's the truth. Just because they agree doesn't mean it's true. And now I'm going to have to cut this out because I'm going to have to make a lot of noise here, and I'm going to have to use a little more brain power, a little more than half of my brain power, to continue with this repair, because there's something really crazy inside under where I pulled this fastener out. So, we'll continue this in a little bit. Back now, folks. I got everything ready to go on the repair. Now I just gotta mix my adhesive up.
kind of pack it. The way they put this stuff together, it's a two-part adhesive. It's pretty cool. You got it's a single piece of plastic, a single like plastic bag, and it's split down the middle with like a clip and a little rubber, like almost like a rubber dowel that keeps the two sides separate, pinched like that, and you have each part of the adhesive, the part A and the activator, in the same packet. And so once you take that little rubber divider out from between there, you can start mixing the two sides together inside of the packet. And the little clip thing has a nice flat, a nice smooth, slightly rounded back to it, so you can squeeze one side into the other and back and forth. And I know I probably should be wearing gloves for this, because this stuff's pretty nasty from what I hear if it gets on your skin for too long. We don't have a hand wash station here at our hangar, even though something we mentioned a while back that we would like to have, because working on a helicopter is just filthy work. You got hydraulic leakage, you got corrosion grit, you got worn metal grit, where the metal working against metal just kind of, you know, grinds off little fine bits like powder almost. And then, of course, you got the chemicals that we work with. And I would be wearing gloves. We don't really have any decent chemical-resistant rubber gloves, except for my my chemical protective gear, my mop suit, and that's a completely different thing. You keep that separate from this type of stuff so it doesn't get exposed to chemicals until you're actually in a chemical attack. And the only gloves, other gloves I have on me are the leather and cloth aviator gloves they give us. I have those. I keep those in my bag in case I have to come in a little early and I have to climb up on the aircraft when it's been in the sun for a while. Not about to get blistered, burnt fingers again like I did in Afghanistan a couple times from going up to an aircraft and just climbing right up on it without having gloves on. Because it actually, the sun on the aircraft here and the outside heat, it gets hot enough that it will blister your fingers if you're not wearing gloves climbing up them. But I got a homework assignment for y'all. If you, let's see, I'm not getting like two, maybe three people that call my toll-free number, and it's toll-free for you guys. It really is. It's costing me $2 a month, so plus like 3.9 cents a minute or some crap, so I'm already paying for it. You guys might as well call me. Come on now. It's 1-888-82-REVOLT. Easy enough to remember. And I mention it every show, but I got some homework for y'all, so you can call into the, leave a voicemail message on there, and let me know what these chemicals actually are, because I don't really feel like looking them up. I'm probably just going to, since I get back from work in the morning, I'm probably just going to post this and go right to sleep. But it says, warning, causes eye and skin burns. Contains diethylene glycol diaminopropyl ether. Diamine, like diamond, but without an O, with an I in place of the O in diamond. That's diaminopropyl, P-R-O-P-Y-L, ether, and a piperazine, like Piper, A-Z-I-N-E. I don't know what the hell that one is. I understand diethylene glycol and the ether part, but I don't know what the diaminopropyl part is or the piperazine. I'm not a dumb guy, I'm just kind of lazy when it comes to that kind of thing. But I guess what I'm really trying to ask is, could somebody tell me what this is going to do to my balls if I get exposed to it? Is this going to give me more freakishly large-headed children? Like my beloved meathead boys? I jokingly say that. They know that it's a term of endearment we use at the house, and I call them knucklehead or fathead. You know, it's a stooges kind of thing, you know. Three stooges, not Iggy Pop stooges, but yeah, I'm sure you all gathered that. I think I'm in the minority that thinks Iggy Pop when they first hear Stooges instead of thinking Larry Moe Curley and the Curley imitators. Or poor substitutes, I should say. But I think that the reason why my children's heads are so large... God, it sounds horrible. They're not huge heads. You know, not bulb-headed booze babies or anything like that. You know, no fetal alcohol syndrome. They're just slightly larger than average heads, like mine. And I think a lot of it's genetic, but
I have a sneaking suspicion that some of it might have something to do with the experimental Japanese encephalitis vaccine I took as an infantryman. They had us grunts take it, because I think our suspicion was that we were the last round of testing before they tried it out on convicts and animals, but it was pretty cool. I got a day off to monitor for side effects, and possible side effects included hallucinations and dizziness, so, you know, as an infantryman and being a 20-year-old grunt, actually, no, I was 21 at the time of that one, but being a 21-year-old grunt, I thought, well, hell, the Army's going to get me high, and I get the day off to enjoy it, but so I went ahead and took it. As I recall, there was only one guy in our company that didn't agree to take it, so, oh, bastard mosquito, how the hell did you get in here? That's, I was able to give blood for, I think, 7 years. Yeah, I was 93, I took it, and I wasn't allowed to give blood till like, 2000. Because it was a, a little heartburn. But as I said, it was an experimental vaccine. So, now that I've got my goo mixed here, and it's, wow, this stuff's bad. It's already starting to get hot from the chemical reaction that causes it to set. And supposedly it's got a pot life of like 30 to 35 minutes at 77 degrees. But I've only been mixing it for as long as I've been talking to you guys. It's already starting to get hot, so I gotta cut a corner off the bag here and start squeezing it into this hole I gotta fill. So, begin the process here. Now the problem with this stuff already starting to heat up and starting to set is the fact that these inserts I'm putting in are in a composite honeycomb panel, which means that when I drilled in to remove the adhesive around the old adhesive around the old inserts, in order to break some of that adhesive out to get the inserts out, it opened up some of the chambers in the aluminum honeycomb around this. And this adhesive is pretty thick stuff, very viscous, and it doesn't like to go into holes like that very well. And so what that means is that I have to fill this thing up, and I have to wait and wait for it to settle into the holes, and I have to see what I have left as far as room I've got to fill and put some more adhesive in. And it's a mess, because this stuff is just, it's horrible, sticky, gooey crap. And you always put in more than you need, because in this case with adhesives, when you're filling something like this, this thing's a two-part, or it's a two-function adhesive. It's an adhesive and can be used as a filler compound. And so when you're putting it in here to fill something like this, and you're going to fill up those empty chambers around it that have broken open, the rule is too much is always better than not enough. Which is, I don't know if I'm the only one that's been saying that, or the first one that's been saying that around here, but that's something I learned in my studies as a devout subgenius, member of the Church of the Subgenius. I don't know if I'm in good standing anymore, because I think that in the true spirit of the subgenius, I grabbed the wrong freaking tab. But in the true spirit of the subgenius, as I see it, I refused to send in $30 for the renewal when I had already sent in $20 to get all the membership kit. And I figured, you know, hey, true spirit of the subgenius, you know, is not to get suckered. And when I saw that they had made a new fee to renew your membership, I said, you know what, to hell with you. This is, let me be a member of the new schism in the organization here. Damn it. Okay, these inserts, they come with a little tab that's self-adhesive that you put on top of it, and it sticks to it, and it allows you to push the insert into the hole without getting so much adhesive on your fingers. And you're supposed to push it down until you see the adhesive coming through the little holes in the center of it, and that indicates that you've pushed it in and you've got good coverage because there's adhesive coming out those holes. And they're different sizes for the different sizes of fasteners, or different sizes, I keep calling them fasteners, the different size of inserts. And so when you push them in, when you put them on here, they've got, you know, holes different distances apart from each other, and they're different diameters of tabs because of the different diameters of the inserts. And because they're easy enough to tell them apart, and to save space in our bench stock cabinets, we have put them all in the same drawer. And like a dumbass, I went and grabbed a bunch of them, but I didn't double check to see if they were all the right types. And I've got one that's going to work on the larger one. Looks like it's working now. Oh man, it's a lot of excess adhesive. Oh, it's going to suck. I hate this crap. It looks like raspberry sorbet once you have it mixed properly, but believe me, folks, it doesn't taste anywhere as good as raspberry sorbet. I've gotten plenty of it on my fingers in the past, and invariably, being as I am quite primitive and still have the toddler habit of putting my fingers in my mouth, I tend to get a bunch of it in my mouth every once in a while. All right, I can make this smaller tab work. Don't have to get up and go into my damn storage room, dig around some more. Beautiful. Smaller one doesn't have as much excess. Now see, you don't want a lot of excess on these because once this stuff sets, it's like freaking concrete. So you don't want to have a lot of it to sand off when you're done, because it's just a pain in the ass and it takes too long. Alright, nice little bead of it around it. Just enough to ensure that it's set alright. The bigger one, holy crap. Another one of the problems with this is too much excess can run down into the hole on a nearby insert and can foul the threads in there, and then you'll never get a screw in that sucker unless you put a tap and die set through it again, which is almost as much trouble as just drilling out and putting a new one in sometimes. And seeing as we don't have a tap and decent tap and die set here, it's something I want to avoid having to do. Here it comes. Turn the insert. Get that tab in a better position. Wipe some more of the excess. Now we're cooking. Woo, stuff's getting hot. So it's really cool in a way, because when you get it mixed up right, the stuff that's still in the bag, well, occasionally it'll boil over. It'll boil into this like hard plastic foam. It's kind of a light purplish color. And I have purposely boiled it before in a number of times for various repairs, because my job, in a lot of ways, is more an art than a science. And there are occasions when you're doing work with fiberglass where you have to put fiberglass layers on to match the original contour of the piece you're working on. And there might be a big enough chunk missing along like a compound curve where you have, where on the same piece it curves one way, like it'll curve along a x-axis as it curves along the y-axis. So you've got basically, well, just imagine you have like an S or a C-shaped piece of fiberglass, but in cross-section, it's another C-shape, you know, going against that cross-section. And you might have a big chunk of it missing and have to make up that different area. There have been a couple of occasions where I've cleared it with a technical inspector to put a bunch of the stuff in underneath and mix it hot so it foams up, and then just sand that down to the original contour, and then just lay my fiberglass layers on top of that and make it basically into a mold. And then once the fiberglass is all set, just get behind it and route out that stuff, the excess boiled material. I've also done it for artistic purposes. That's the time on my hand last time I was here. And I filled up a half-liter water bottle with it, mixed it hot so it would boil, and then cut the plastic bottle out from around it, and using my sanding and grinding tools, I sculpted it into various little shapes. Being a soldier, I sculpted it into various vulgar shapes, reminiscent of human genitalia. Okay. And that should do it. Now all that's left to do is set it somewhere where no one's going to mess with it, oriented in such a way that when they come upon it, it's obvious that there's fresh adhesive on it, and then just wait. As I said, it should take probably 8 to 10 hours before this stuff's at a workable degree of hardness. And it should be fully set to sandable hardness within 24 hours. But in order for this stuff to set completely all the way through, it takes 7 days at 77 degrees. And of course, with just about anything else chemical, it will take longer or shorter amount of time based on the heat and the ambient heat and humidity. The biggest problem we had during the winter was that this stuff wouldn't start to set at all, because for the the heat reaction has to be above 77 degrees for it to start to take effect. Well, efficiently take effect. It can hit at, lower temperatures than that, but if you don't have it at least 70 degrees, you're not guaranteed that the reaction is going to start and start the chain reaction that sets the adhesive. And we were having problems with that in the winter, where you'd have to put a heat gun on it in order to get it hot enough for it to start itself. And once it starts itself, then it generates enough of its own heat that the thermal runaway occurs. I know that's an electronics term, but it's very similar in a way to what happens, in that thermal runaway in an electronic system, as the current rises and heat rises, resistance drops. As resistance drops, the current flow is able to increase, which increases the heat, which further drops the resistance, and the process increases exponentially, and it's called thermal runaway. In a similar manner, this stuff generates, so once it gets that heat, it generates its own heat, which basically accelerates the process. And now this stuff doesn't give off discernible, harsh fumes when it does that, but we have some chemicals that are pretty damn nasty. And, yay, there's the end of the boring, only technically interesting portion of the program, which I will call This Old Chinook. And now it's time to move on to another portion here, because I have gone on quite a while on this section, and already have about 20 minutes on the previous segment, so this looks to be another long show, and I know you guys don't mind that at all.